Thanks. It's a great honor to be able to give this talk and to be to receive the prize. And so I'm really happy to be here today. I'm going to talk about something that has intrigued me since I was a postdoc back in the early 90s, and something I've continued to work on for several decades. And this is understanding mathematically the process of biological invasions. And biological invasions from a ecological perspective really shape the environment we see nowadays, and have been estimated that after habitat destruction, biological invasions are the largest influence on species numbers. I want to show you a rather benign biological invasion that someone called Skellum looked at in the 50s. And just to give you an idea of what it looks like, it turned out that in 1905, muskrats were imported from Alaska to Prague, which is right about here on this map of concentric rings. And they were bred, and then they escaped. And then they grew, and they spatially spread. And what you see here, it's a little hard to see, but 1905, 1907, all the way down to about 1927, these are sort of concentric rings that show how far this population has spread away from Prague. And if you plot the square root of the area as some measure of the radius versus time, you see that there's more or less a straight line, which interestingly changes its slope during the First World War, and then it straightens out again. So when people look at things like biological invasions, they're interested in the slope of its line. Okay, how quickly does a population spread spatially? Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today is work that goes back to Fisher and people like Kolmogorov in the 30s, trying to understand this very question, and the kind of classical theory of nonlinear partial differential equations applied to population spread. And then I want to talk about some newer work on non-local spread. So how do populations spread when there are rare long-distance dispersal events? And this can change the dynamics considerably. I want to move on and then talk a little bit about non-linear kinds of interactions that can happen in populations. And these are non-linear stochastic effects. And they can really affect the way that the population will spread. And finally, I want to move to population spread with multiple interacting species. And throughout, I'd like to kind of look at the biological context, go to the mathematics, and then come back to the biology. So looking at things from a broad perspective, you might ask yourself, can an invading population establish itself in a new environment? Will it spread, and if so, at what speed? And what impact will it have? I'm going to focus on the second question here. What speed will it spread at? The earliest model really goes back to the work of the geneticist Fisher, and he used a nonlinear partial differential equation for the rate of change of density. This involves growth with this nonlinear quadratic function and dispersal via diffusion. U now is the density or expected density of genes, or in an ecological context, we'll think about this as population density. R we'd refer to as an intrinsic growth rate. D is a diffusion coefficient. And F is our nonlinear growth function. So F looks like this. It's important to remember the shape. It has zeros at 0 and 1, and it's concave down. So this model was initially used to try to understand the rate of spread of an advantageous gene into a new environment. But at the same time as Fisher was thinking about this, Kolmogorov, Petrovsky, and Tiskunov, three Russian mathematicians were analyzing this, and this is sometimes also referred to as the KPP equation. If we move forward about 40 years, I guess, Aronson and Weinberger at Minnesota studied this also. So what Kolmogorov and co-workers showed was that if you have a step function initial condition, so it's equal to 1 to one side of the origin and 0 on the other side, that initial data will converge to a wave that spreads with a given speed. And the speed is 2 times the square root of r times d. R and d on the previous slide were the growth rate and the diffusion coefficient. If we look at something closer to a biological invasion process where you have some compact set where you introduce a population, that will also grow and spread. And Aronson and Weinberger showed that this wave will spread in both directions and asymptotically achieve the same speed, c. Okay, and so how did they show that? Well, they constructed an upper solution and a lower solution, and they showed something about these two solutions. In fact, they showed that both of these would asymptotically spread at this same speed c, and then the true solution lay sandwiched in between. And because this is a parabolic partial differential equation, as a scalar, we can come up with a comparison principle that says that solutions that are initially well ordered will keep the same ordering through time. And so this solution would be squeezed in between, and then we can deduce the property that that will spread. It's interesting that a chemist, Luther, in 1906, was looking at the spatially distributed chemical reaction, and he suggested that the rate that spread was proportional to the square root of r times d also. He didn't really have the mathematics, but if we go back and look at the units here, r is a rate, d is a diffusion coefficient. So if we multiply these two and take the square root, we get a speed. And that was Luther's argument, just based on dimensional analysis. This formula, it turns out, has been very popular with ecologists. And as I'll show a little bit later, they actually go out and measure the growth rates and the diffusion coefficients and try to estimate the spreading speed from first principles for populations. If we want to define a spreading speed or a spread rate, we need to be a little more precise than I've been so far. We think about some locally introduced population, and this is the way that Aronson and Weinberger looked at this. We have one equilibrium at 0 and one at 1. This wave is connecting 0 to 1, and the idea is if you run a little bit faster than the wave speed, eventually you'll see 0, and if you run a little bit slower than the wave speed, eventually you'll see 1. And that's what these inequalities show here. If you think about it graphically, if we introduce a population here and we numerically solve the partial differential equation, it's going to grow and spread. And we can plot this in space versus time. And the gray area is close to 1, and the hatched area is close to 0. Now, we could think about a line starting from the origin with slope c, okay? And this would correspond, if the slope is too large, you'll eventually see 0 for anything with that slope or greater in magnitude. So we're in the hatched region. And if we're in this situation here, c minus epsilon, okay, for small epsilon, you'll get into the gray region. And that's a sort of a more rigorous definition of what one means by spreading speed. We can either think about it graphically, or we can think about it from the perspective of an individual moving a little bit faster than the wave or a little bit slower than the wave. Okay, so from the previous slide, with that definition, Fisher's model has a spreading speed of 2 times the square root of r times d. So we can think about this another way, or people have classically, and we can think about a traveling wave. And so a traveling wave is a wave that retains its shape and moves at a constant speed across the domain without changing its shape. And so if we take our initial equation here with the same f as we had before, we can move to traveling wave coordinates. And that specifies the relationship between x and t, space and time. In particular, we're looking for a very special kind of solution. So we make an ansatz that this solution here only depends on z, where z is this traveling wave coordinate, x minus ct. So it's a moving frame moving at speed, exactly at speed c. And so that transforms this partial differential equation into an ordinary differential equation, where c here is a free parameter. It's the wave speed. We don't know yet what that's going to be. And then we give boundary conditions that say, well, we're going to start at 0, and we're going to move to 1. So graphically, it looks like this. This is the traveling wave in z coordinate. Okay? And if it were, if this were x, it would show the wave moving to the right at speed c. Okay? So it turns out there, when you analyze this nonlinear first-order ordinary differential equation, there's a whole family of traveling wave solutions with wave speed c, providing c is bigger than this critical wave speed c star. So this is relationship between spreading speeds and traveling wave speeds, where the minimum traveling wave speed is the spreading speed. And so there's a sort of this interesting two perspectives we can take on invasions. Here, of course, we're not really taking into account the initial data describing the population, but when we look at the spreading speed, we are. Okay. Okay. So how do you get to that magic formula? And really, the answer is, you replace a nonlinear problem by a linear problem. We don't really know how to solve most nonlinear problems, and we know how to solve most linear problems. And so the idea is that this is our original model with the F shown here. The linearization about the leading edge of the wave, or when u is small, is shown by the straight line here. In our previous example, F prime, the slope of the line would be the intrinsic growth rate, R. And we have the property that this thing lies below its linearization. It turns out that for this kind of simple model, the spread rate is linearly determined I'll put that on the next slide. It's linearly determined if the spread rate of the nonlinear system equals the spread rate of the linear system. And it turns out for this system, it is linearly determined. And to see how to think about that, we can look at two different ways. Here again is our linearization. This is the F prime, or the slope of that line, which is the intrinsic growth rate. Think about starting off with an individual at x equals 0 at time equals 0. This is a diffusion equation with exponential growth. So we're going to get a Gaussian that grows and expands over time. And actually, in this simple case, we can write down what the formula is here. And then we can think about taking a level set for that Gaussian, which we can think of as a threshold for detection. And the level set is shown here as u critical. And where it crosses the solution, that'll be x critical. But that'll depend on time, because as the solution grows, xc will change. So it's possible to show for this kind of system that if time goes to infinity, the rate of change of this threshold equals this c star, 2 times the square root of r times d. And this can be done explicitly by calculating on the back of an envelope, actually. Okay. The other way we can look at this linear system is from the perspective of a traveling wave. So we have a linear system here, and we look for exponentially decaying solutions. But now they're in these traveling wave coordinates. This is our previous z that we had in our traveling wave system. Now, if we just make the ansatz and plug this into the equation, we'll get what's called the dispersion relation. So here, the dispersion relation relates C and S. S is the steepness of the wave, the exponential decay rate, and C is the speed. So if we plug in, we'll get C S is R times dS squared. Because when we differentiate twice, we'll bring down S squared here. And we'll bring down a C times S here. And I think there may be some technical noise, but I'll keep lecturing unless someone asks me to stop. So now if we solve this for C, this is called the dispersion relation. Okay? So C now is equal to this function of S, which we can plot. And if we evaluate the minimum, okay, its minimum is exactly at 2 times the square root of r times d. Okay, so this is its minimum wave speed. So this is the traveling wave side, this is sort of the spreading speed side. Okay, so under what conditions are these kinds of systems linearly determined? Well, it turns out that in the scalar system, it's actually fairly straightforward to understand based on the work of Aaronson and Weinberger in the 70s and Hadler and Rotte also in the 70s. And if we look at the function f, it has to strictly lie below its linearization. And in this case here, anything of this shape will be linearly determined. But if we have a change in concavity of the form shown here, the function would lie above its linearization. And so it wouldn't necessarily be linearly determined for this situation on the right-hand side. This is often referred to in the ecological context as an Allee effect. Your per capita growth rate is diminished at low densities. Okay, so at the time I was a postdoc, people were applying this theory to all kinds of different invaders. So this is the spread of the bubonic plague in the medieval times, in the 1400s across Europe. This is a spread of rabies, and this is the muskrat data, sea otters, gypsy moth, cabbage white butterfly, different phyla. Okay, we can plot the theoretical spread rate here and the observed spread rate here. And the bars show the maximum and minimum values as evaluated over a variety of different circumstances. And of course, it looks a bit better in a log-log scale in terms of showing. I see the biologists are smiling here. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book. But nonetheless, this is considered to be a real success story in correlating theory and practice in ecology. Except there's some other that are really well off that line. And it turns out what's happening here is there are these rare long-distance dispersal events that are probably driving the spread of both trees and these cereal leaf beetles. And so cereal leaf beetles tend to be in a field, and then they get picked up by the wind, and then they get transported, and then they drop in a long way away. And this isn't really diffusion anymore. It's a rare long-distance jump. And oak trees, this is looking at the spread of oak trees after the last ice age, as they spread both in Europe and in North America. And there, most of the acorns fall close to the tree, but occasionally one gets picked up and moved a long way by birds or perhaps by sort of 1 in 100 year winds. And so, again, there's long distance dispersal here. So how do we understand that? Well, we need something that looks at non-local spread. Now, if we look at the data for oak trees, I'm going to go back from 20,000 years to 10,000 years ago. So we start at 20,000 before present. Here, this is from the American Pollen Database. These are the percentages, and so dark is a higher percentage. And so we can move forward by increments of 2,000 years. The blue is the retreating ice sheets. And so now we see a core oak population moving forward. And in the last 10,000 years, this species of oak hasn't really changed very much in its location. Okay, so when you work out an average spreading speed, it turns out to be about 100 to 200 meters per year, which is higher than Fisher's theory would predict. So what do we do here? Well, we can think about what we assumed when we had this reaction diffusion equation. And if we have diffusion, we're assuming that propagules move with a Gaussian dispersal function over a fixed period of time. So over one time unit, they'd have a normal distribution with the variance 2 times the diffusion coefficient. If you add in rare long-distance dispersal events, you could think about, you know, a large fraction would disperse locally, and a very small fraction would disperse a long way. So here, this is p times k1. This is 1 minus p times k2. And then this dispersal function would be the linear combination of these two things. OK, so you might say, now, if we had a spread model that includes this, what happens? And interestingly, dispersal kernels can be measured directly for a lot of species. And so this is a very sort of powerful modeling formalism biologically, not only for trees but for insects and other plants. So the modeling formalism that's useful here is something that tracks, say, from year to year what's going on, so time units of one. And here we have a growth function, and here we have a dispersal function. And so the idea is individuals will grow at location Y and then disperse according to this dispersal function. So this is a nonlinear operator. Okay, it's still a scalar operator, and it takes in U sub n and it spits out U sub n plus 1. Here, this is the growth function, and we can think about its linearization just like we did for the other one. And the fixed points will be where this growth function crosses the 45-degree line. So there's a steady state at 0, and then there's 1 here. Okay, so we might say, can we understand this? And this is actually something I started to think about in the early 90s with Mark Codd. And so we can do the same thing that we've done before and linearize about the leading edge of this operator, okay? And if we use the method that we talked about before, then we would replace this function by the straight line, and we get a linear operator here. And we can analyze this. And one way to do it is with this traveling wave leading edge. It looks like this, but now n is time. So n is shows here in the traveling wave coordinates. And again, we can get a dispersion relation between the wave speed c and the steepness s, much in the way that we did for the linear reaction diffusion equation. And when we go through this and we put this into here, we'll get something that looks like e to the sc is equal to, we need to do the integration, right? And it turns out it's the moment generating function of the kernel that comes out of this, times R naught. This is the moment generating function. It's like almost like a Laplace transform, but it's over the entire real line. So providing this exists. So we need to have some constraints on the kernel K so that this integral will actually converge. Okay, if it drops off slower than exponential, then we won't actually be able to calculate this. So if we go to back to the Fisher model, this is exactly what we did here, and the appropriate speed was the minimum of C of S. So it turns out that the same story holds here effectively, and we thought we'd discovered this, and we wrote this up, and the paper went to Hans Weinberger, and he said, it's very nice that people are popularizing my previous results, and gave us a very nice review and suggestions of how to improve some of our proofs in here. And so the theorem is his. And basically, there's constraints on the growth function. It has to lie below its linearization, okay? And we have to be able to calculate this moment generating function. And then we have the same result. It's not as compact as it was for the reaction diffusion equation. Now here, S, again, is the wave steepness, and we choose the S that gives the minimum value for this here, and then that gives the C star. R naught now is the derivative at zero, and biologically we interpret this as a geometric growth rate because we're in discrete time. Okay, so how does the proof go? The proof is actually rather difficult, even though it's easy to state the theorem, because you have to create, do the same ideas as the earlier work and create a subsolution and a supersolution. And these are created iteratively. And then use a comparison theorem to derive the result for the nonlinear system. Okay. So, but the ideas are the same as in the partial differential equation. Right, so if you plug in this value for a Gaussian here, a dispersal kernel with variance 2 times d, and you say the arithmetic growth rate is the log of the geometric growth rate, which is what you would intuitively expect, then you get the Fisher wave feedback. Okay, so that's sort of reassuring that somehow in that particular situation we get back to what we thought we would expect. If you have these dispersal functions that have these long distance dispersers, it turns out that the spreading speed increases by an order of magnitude. And so suddenly you're getting very rapid invasions. And this is sort of how we can understand the spread of the trees. In fact, it's really interesting. If you get a dispersal function where the moment generating function doesn't exist, then you might say, what can we do? We can't apply Weinberger's theorem anymore. But it turns out you can actually compute spreading speeds in a large class of models. And these give constantly accelerating invasions. So if spreading speed doesn't exist, the spread just grows faster and faster over time as the wave spreads and becomes more and more shallow. And so just as a little example here, if you have a fat tail kernel, this is something that doesn't have a moment generating function. So it has curls, tails that are not exponentially bounded. You will see something like this when you plot invaded distance versus time. So the slope is constantly increasing. Okay, so in the late 90s, Jim Clark, who was a tree biologist at Duke, got quite excited about this theory, and he was looking at paleobiological things. And so this is work with Jim on red maple, and he fitted the local dispersal kernel for red maple, and then he added in 5% long-distance dispersers with what he called a fin tail, and then 5% with a fatter tail. And this was actually a little more complicated. It was a stochastic simulation. But if you plot the rate of spread versus time, you see the one with the fat tail increases fairly rapidly up to about 100 meters per year here, whereas the one with the thin tail are spreading very slowly. So that was came out in a paper saying, how do trees migrate? Something that maybe people hadn't thought about too much prior to that. If we look at other data for invasions, this is data for cheatgrass. Okay, so cheatgrass is moved by railways, and then it spreads locally. And it's a weed that gets in with wheat. And it's actually rather pernicious, and it decreases the productivity in farmers' fields. And so a biologist called Mack looked at this in the early 80s, and he tried to reconstruct the spread of cheatgrass in Western North America. So Vancouver's here, and we're looking at the western states. This is where I used to live in Salt Lake City. And you'll see, well, there's a couple of things. If you just cut down here, you'll see that there's definitely an accelerating invasion going on here if you plot the range radius versus time. Okay, but there's something else going on. Things look really patchy. This doesn't look like a traveling wave, a smooth traveling wave. So there's something going on here associated with this transportation. So if you think of a railway car moving cheatgrass, maybe 1,000 kilometers, by the siding, it'll grow, okay? That'll be one of these little patches. And so somehow our models for invasions need to take into account this sort of stochastic aspect. So that's what I want to talk about next. And so it's common to see a series of invaded patches that spread and coalesce and spawn new patches if you look at data for invasions. And if you do Monte Carlo simulations, you get similar results. So here's a simple Monte Carlo simulation where you start with a single origin, individual at the origin, and they end off producing a Poisson number of offspring. And then each of the offspring disperse according to one of these dispersal functions with sufficient long-distance dispersers. And then you plot the solution in two dimensions after a certain number of time steps. So this is one simulation, okay, and this is another simulation. The only difference was the initial seed in the random number generator. So you'll see there's a lot of variation between different realizations of this stochastic process. And furthermore, if you say you're maybe in this region out here, okay, quite far from where it started, the expected density is low when you average expectation over all the realizations of the stochastic process. But if you're an individual out here, in this particular realization of the stochastic process, you're likely to have neighbors around you. So it appears that density-dependent effects could be important at the leading edge of the wave, even though the theory we've been talking about says that they're not, okay, because they're formulated in this mean field way. Welcome. I think we might have lost them. Did you want to take a break, or? Oh, okay. Should I just keep going then? Okay, I'm happy to do that. Okay. So this is sort of interesting. And initially, we were puzzled and we just simulated it, and then we thought, what can we do about it? And we might say, how does this relate to the models we've already seen? And so one thing we can do is kind of use the ideas of physics and look at the moments, the spatial moments of the process. So we can think about the expected density of individuals as n, and then there's a joint density, the probability associated with having one individual at x and one at y. Call that n superscript 2. And then the covariance, the spatial covariance between these two points, would be the joint density minus the products of the densities. And if there's correlations, the covariance will be positive, and if there's negative correlations, it'll be negative. And so we could take the linear process we've just simulated and try to understand it in the context of the moments of the equation. And so the first moment is just the linear integral difference equation. And now the covariance turns out to involve a couple of terms. The first term here, when you do the derivation, is these are siblings that both had the same parent. So the parent was at z, and one offspring went to x, and one went to y. And so this is how correlations can grow from having the same parent. And correlations can also grow from having from passing down from one generation to the next. So these are individuals correlated at z1 and z2. Z1 produces an offspring at x, and z2 at y. Okay, and then we could write down third order and fourth order moments if we wanted to. Notice that these aren't coupled, so I could solve that and plug it in there. And when you do that, it's possible to show that this is a positive wave, so the correlations are always positive, and it's an expanding wave. So you get a wave of expectation and a wave of correlations that expand as well. How about if we put in nonlinear interactions now? So let's think about the easiest way we can do that. We could say, well, let's look at an epsilon neighborhood around an individual. And the behavioral rules would be look around in an epsilon neighborhood, and if there's no other individuals in there, produce your offspring and die. If there are individuals around you, don't produce offspring and then die. Okay. And this is discrete non-overlapping generations. And then the offspring become parents, and we continue the process. Okay, so if we were to write this down with the kind of model we've been looking at so far, we would have this nonlinear term in here. This is the size of the local neighborhood, epsilon being small, and this is the n squared. Okay, and this doesn't exactly, it turns out, it doesn't exactly meet the criteria of having a monotonic growth function that Weinberger's theorem requires, but you can get around that, and the spreading speed is linearly determined. So the nonlinear interactions have no effect. But if you actually do the simulations, you see something different. And so here, we need a way of describing what a spreading speed is for this process. And one way to do it is to define something called the expectation speed. So you choose a number, n sub e, like 10 or 20, and it turns out it doesn't matter exactly what that number is as long as it's small. And then for each realization of your stochastic process, you look at how the 20th furthest forward individual moves over time, and then you average this over many realizations of your stochastic process. And so this is called expectation speed. And this is what the linear theory would predict is the solid line. location versus time. And as the size of that neighborhood grows, the slope of the line goes down. Okay, so these interactions do have an effect. The larger the neighborhood is, the more effect they have. So how do we think about this now? Well, what we really need to put in here is not nt squared, but we want to put in the joint density of having a particle here and having a particle right beside it nearby. So that'd be like that n2 function. But we can write the joint density as the density squared plus the covariance. Okay, so because the covariance is the difference between the joint density and the density squared. And so now there is a term here, okay, that appears in this equation. And now there'll be an equation for the covariance, but it's going to involve the higher order moments. And so we, like we normally would for these processes, we get a series of coupled equations, an infinite series of coupled equations, because the lower ones are coupled to the higher, and the higher to the lower. Okay, that describes the stochastic process. And so basically, you can't solve it. But one thing you can do is take a method from physics and say, well, we'd like to come up with some kind of moment closure. So we'd like to say, well, at some point, we're going to neglect some terms that we don't think are important, or we're going to approximate those terms, and then we can close off our system. And so that's an idea that I used a while ago to look at this system. And it turns out that you can describe a spreading speed that depends on the neighborhood of interaction size, as long as it's small, where it looks very much like the Weinberger spreading speed, except there's a modification. It depends on the size of the neighborhood. And it's the, here, instead of just having the kernel in there, there's the kernel minus epsilon times the geometric growth rate times the kernel squared. I'd like to go back and compare that formula to the one we saw here. So this is really the case where epsilon is equal to zero. Okay, so we just have the moment generating function in there for the kernel K. And now it's got this other term in it, which is right here. So another way of thinking about this, it would be as if we took our dispersal function here and we modified it by subtracting off epsilon times R0 times the kernel squared. Okay? And we can interpret this in another way as being the interference that you get from your siblings. Okay? And so basically, to come up with a proof for this, you need to use a moment closure method, but then figure out what it is you're throwing away and what the sign of that is. So if you know the sign of it, then you can use a comparison theorem, okay, to say it produces an upper bound on the speed. And so it's kind of putting these things together. And if you want to, you can get a lower bound as well, but it's a little more involved. And so this is kind of a proof that, yeah, these correlations do matter, like the numeric said, but kind of gives an idea of how to look at it. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I want to talk about another problem that's really intrigued me over the years, and this is spread with multiple species. Okay, so the British love their animals, and they love their red squirrels. And this is a little faded with light, but it used to be that England was entirely red. There were only red squirrels, and these nasty gray squirrels were introduced, and they're about twice the size. Okay. And they're much better competitors, and they've spread spatially, and they've replaced the red squirrel throughout most of Britain. And so here is this is 2008. This is all gray. Okay, there's an area without squirrels here. This is where gray squirrels are spreading into red and pushing them back, and they've moved into Ireland as well. Okay, so we've got a population spread where there's a competitor, and it turns out that the one that's moving in is the better competitor. And here's another example of a multi-species invasion. And in fact, this is something that Haiping Zhu has done a lot of work on, and people at York, and spread of West Nile virus. And here it was introduced in New York about 1999, perhaps in a shipment of fruit. And then the virus spread from mosquitoes to birds, and it spread across North America. Okay, and this is Canada and the United States showing the states and the provinces. And there's a wave of invasion from west to east. And you'll notice in some of this data, it shows, like, say, in Alberta, it wasn't there really in 2000, and then 2002, there was a big outbreak, and then we see a decrease again. Sort of a wave that drops down. Okay, so how do we understand this mathematically? Well, this is something I worked on for almost 10 years with Bing Tuan Lee, who was a postdoc of mine, and Hans Weinberger, and we kind of wrote a series of papers on this. And so the basic ideas in this are that when you're in higher dimensions, you can use similar methods that we talked about for the discrete time integral difference equations. So comparison theorems, super solutions, and subsolutions, providing the dynamics are cooperative. Okay, so species one has to help species two, and species two has to help species one. And this is required for the operator to have a comparison theorem. So in higher dimensions, you require this cooperativity to be able to say something about the ordering of your solutions. And it's possible to go back and forth from partial differential equation models to these discrete time models. And so sometimes it's easier to actually solve them in discrete time and then map back to continuous time. And the theory that we worked on was formulated initially by Louis in the late 80s and then was extended into a series of about five papers in the mid-2000s. And it's been fully developed, or further developed, by many other people, including some people in the room, and Horst Thieme and Zhao at Memorial University. And so here are the kinds of questions that we were asking and thinking about. We have a nonlinear spatial operator. Now U is a vector, okay? So when does a spreading speed exist? It may be that there isn't a spreading speed. It could be that components spread at different speeds. So it's not unheard of that you'll have one speed for one component and one for another. So you need to compute a maximum and a minimum spreading speed and find conditions under which they're identical if you want a single spreading speed. How do you know that the spreading speed is linearly determined? Understood for the scalar models, but what about vector models? Well, there's a condition a little bit like your function has to, your growth function in higher dimensions has to lie below its linearization. But it's not quite as simple as that. It really matters that this function lies below the linearization at the leading edge of the wave. So when components are in a certain direction. And how do you translate these conditions into constraints on the interacting species? And how can you weaken conditions, maybe, so as to be able to address a broader class of questions? How to translate between discrete time and continuous time models, and how to connect to the traveling wave analysis. Okay, before there was this connection between the minimum wave speed for a family of traveling waves and the spreading speed. Okay, so let's go back to the squirrels. And now it's color-coded, so these are the reds that are being pushed back. Okay, these are the grays that are moving in. This is U, the grays. Okay, so we can see the population spreading here. And so we can think about this as a spreading population for the grays moving into the red. Now you might say, let's suppose our parameters are like this. So A1 is less than 1, and A2 is greater than 1. This is a Lotka-Volterra competition, so that means that grays affect reds more than reds affect grays. That makes the grays a better competitor. And early researchers said, well, let's look at the leading edge of the wave here. V is approximately 1, okay, at the equilibrium here, when U is equal to 0. So if we were to plug V equals 1 into here, we would get this equation right here. So this would simply be, I did something a little different. I linearized about U equals 0 and V is equal to 1. Okay, and got the linear system at the leading edge. And it just turns out to be something we've seen before. Okay, that was that linear PDE that we looked at earlier for Fisher's equation, but now the growth rate is scaled by this quantity here, which is the effect of competition on the grays from the reds. So that should slow things down. So if we apply Fisher's result, we know the spreading speed. And it's given here, 2 times the square root of the growth rate, r times 1 minus a1, times the diffusion coefficient. So Hosono, in the late 90s, performed this experiment. And he said, let's just numerically solve this and see what happens. And he plotted this speed numerically as a function of the diffusion coefficient for the second species, the red squirrel species. Okay, it's this diffusion coefficient here. Well, that doesn't appear in the formula. Okay, but the spreading speed does change as D2 changes. So this is what the linear theory would predict, and this is what's observed. So this is actually turns out to be a really interesting case. It's a single model where sometimes the spreading speed is linearly determined and sometimes it's not. It depends on the parameters. And this is what Hosono found out in the late 90s. And we were interested in using this as a test case for our theory to see if we could understand what was going on. So we wanted to change this now from a competitive system into a cooperative system, because remember, the theory only works when things cooperate. So it's an old trick, but you can just turn around, P, U competes with V, so P is U, Q is 1 minus V, so P helps Q, and Q helps V now by doing this change of variables. You move from competition to cooperation by just doing a change of variables. Okay, and we can then put this into a discrete time recursion by looking at the time tau map for the PDE, and we'll get an order-preserving nonlinear spatial operator. We can apply this sort of theory to it, okay? And in this case, it turns out that you can get a condition for linear spread. Okay, so there's an inequality here between the parameters that is a sufficient condition for the linear theory to hold. And I'll just focus on D2 here. So we want this quantity to be bigger than this quantity, and this quantity here is greater than or equal to 0. So we need D2 to be less than 2D1. And so when we go back to our numerical results, D1 was equal to 1. And so at this point here, the left of this point, the theory says it should be linearly determined. To the right, it says that these sufficient conditions aren't satisfied. So we don't actually know. But it doesn't appear to be. Okay, so Hosono took another approach. He used a singular perturbation approach and scaled parameters. And so he could collapse the two equation system into one equation, and he took a limit on D2 going the other way. Growth rate for the red squirrels is very large, and he said, and under that circumstance, the gray squirrel population would obey this equation here, the scalar equation. So this is like an approximation that's a singular perturbation approach, and the function looks like this. Okay, so this function doesn't lie below its linearization. So if we go back to this situation here, we're in a situation that looks like this. Okay, so that's another way we can intuitively understand what's going on. Okay, I guess I probably just have a 1 or 2 minutes, right? So 5 minutes? Okay, so I think I'll have time to go through this. So here's the last example I want to talk about. It's the spread of West Nile virus across North America, and there's a variety of different models. This is one that we looked at with larvae, susceptible, exposed, and infected mosquitoes, and susceptible and infected birds. And there's this interplay between mosquitoes and birds. So mosquitoes infect birds, and then birds reinfect mosquitoes, returning the favor. And we have the 4 classes. We have birth and death in the larval class and transfer to the susceptible class. Movement of mosquitoes and movement of birds. And then the infected mosquitoes are going to infect the birds here. And the infected birds are going to expose the mosquitoes to the disease here. Okay, so this is a nonlinear system of partial differential equations. And we're interested in a spreading speed for this. Well, it's a little bit intimidating because there's six equations. But it turns out there are some tricks that one can use in this and just simplify the model by taking the limits of certain parameters and find an invariant stable manifold for a simpler model that only involves infected mosquitoes and infected birds. Now, in this sense, the infected mosquitoes help the infected birds because help them get infected, right? Help increase them, and the infected birds help the infected mosquitoes. So there's this cooperativity in this cross-infection dynamic. And one can work out the spreading speed for the simple system and then relate it back to the more complicated system, again, using a comparison theorem by saying, well, the limits of the parameters we took are the terms we threw away. When we put them back in, how will that affect the speed? Okay, and so we basically end up using a comparison theorem to relate it back to the full model. And so here, just as a little simulation, this is the infected bird, a population moving forward in time, and over about 1,000 kilometers. The solution to the full seven-component system is here. This is the approximate solution. And we see it, the one is moving a little faster than the other. We know how to compute the speed of this analytically. Of course, we can compute this on the computer. And you'll see the way this one doesn't come down, whereas this one does. So linear predictability is really useful. And it's been the subject of a great deal of work going back to Fisher, about 80 years of work. And the reason is because it allows us to solve a problem that's nonlinear, which is inherently very difficult to solve, by replacing it with one that we do know how to solve. And it's been subject of much mathematical research. Rare long-distance dispersal events can drive these invasions, but they're very difficult to measure. So this produces a lot of uncertainty in our estimates for spreading speeds. But we know how to put this in the theory. And they can increase the spreading speeds by an order of magnitude, like with the oak trees. Really, we should be thinking about stochastic processes, but rarely have people done this for invasions, although there is some theory, some beautiful theory out there. But there's a lot of open questions. And in multi-species models, linear predictability is not well understood and is a subject of ongoing research. And if you have something like a predator-prey system, then your prey is going to hurt your predator. Oh, no, hold on. Your predator is going to hurt your prey, but your prey is going to help your predator. So you have this asymmetric kind of interaction. And there's no way you can do a little change of variables to get rid of that asymmetry in the interaction. And so it's really an open problem as to how to apply this theory or extend this theory for non-cooperative systems. And there's a couple of groups working on this right now, and sort of papers are in review on this. And I thought I'd just finish with this simulation. This is what happens when your predator is invading your prey population. It's moving to the right. And here you see the frames are going forward, just 12 frames. And it's slowly spreading. When you calculate the spreading speed, it appears to be linearly determined. But there's all kinds of exotic behaviors in the back of the wave. You have an oscillatory wave train that becomes unstable and eventually chaotic. And this is a very generic property for predator-prey invasions. So this is just to say we're scratching at the surface, and there's a lot of work to be done. And finally, I just want to say, I've talked about primarily the work I've done in the context of the history, but there's a lot of work going on by a lot of groups here, and some people in the audience also, such as spread and epidemic models, and it's a very active area of research, and Canada's one of the hot spots for it. So thank you. Thank you.